calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to the radio support group Up By It For We the People of the United States. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day by Thomas Jefferson, speaking to Archibald Stewart in 1791. He said, "I would rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending too much liberty than to those attending too small a degree of it." Coming up later on today's program, former Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives Ben Barnes, the guy who got George W. Bush into the Texas Air National Guard, going to come and tell us about what that was like, what Texas was like back in those days, and what his feelings are about that, as well as what kind of guy George W. Bush was. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Right now, Elon Giorno is with us. Am I pronouncing your name right, Elon?
Yes, you are.
Great. Elon Giorno is with us. He's a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute and an author of many of their op-ed pieces, AYNRAND.org, the website. And Elon, I'm assuming you wrote this piece, Stop Appeasing and Start Attacking Rand?
Yes, I did.
So give me a snapshot of this.
Well,
give it to our listeners, rather.
Sure. Iran is a hostile nation seeking nuclear weapons, and it is our government's job to protect Americans. And what we find instead is that the government is groveling along with its European friend in trying to appease Iran. And that is a recipe for disaster. Diplomacy of this kind, and I put that in scare quotes, diplomacy of that kind is suicidal. It's going to make Iran better off, stronger, and more hostile. It's going to encourage other terrorists all over the place. It's going to make the U.S. and Europeans weaker, in effect. And ultimately, we're going to face some kind of huge standoff with an Iran that everyone implicitly now accepts will end up with nuclear weapons. So it's completely self-defeating, and it's immoral.
Now, let's see, in the last couple hundred years, if my recollection of history is right, and it's been some years, so I may be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, Iran has been attacked by the Ottoman Empire. They've been attacked by the Germans. They've been attacked by Iraq, by Saddam Hussein. To the best of my knowledge, Iran has never attacked another nation. Why do you say that they're a hostile power?
Well, they may not have mounted wars of the kind that you describe, but they certainly have funded proxies. The main one we all hear about is Hezbollah in Lebanon and also operating in the West Bank and Gaza Strip occasionally, and around the world. It also harbors and trains and helps support other groups. And we've seen, I think the 9/11 Commission report noted that some of the 9/11 hijackers went through Iran at some point.
But the amount of funding that Iran is providing to this stuff is bupkis compared to what Saudi Arabia is funding. And shouldn't we be attacking Saudi Arabia if that's your criteria?
Hey, I agree. I mean,
you want us to invade Saudi Arabia as well?
I think both of them are dangerous. Iran is probably the more dangerous right now because it is seeking a weapon that would give it far greater reach than it has right now.
How do you know Saudi Arabia isn't?
Pardon?
How do you know Saudi Arabia isn't? They're sitting on such a huge pile of cash, much of it our money. I mean, money that we have borrowed from them. You know, sitting on so many of our debt instruments and money that we gave them to buy oil. That, you know, in an afternoon, they could buy a nuclear weapon from, for example, Pakistan, our so-called ally.
Yeah, you know, it could well be that they're doing this, but I put Iran and Saudi Arabia in the same category. Both of them are adamantly working and financing the spread of totalitarian Islam, and they're doing it through proxies that use terrorism against the West and America in particular. I think, and they're hostile to each other, too, which is another reason to worry.
Well, that's because it's Shia versus Sunni. But, Elon Giorno, one of the most effective ways that Hezbollah and Hamas, for that matter, have spread their influence across the Middle East has been by building hospitals, building schools, and feeding people. You'll give me that, I'm assuming. You'll acknowledge that.
Yeah, I don't think that's something we can dispute.
Right. Okay. So if the most effective way that a really nasty SOB terrorist organization can bring into its sway millions, tens of millions of people is by feeding people, building hospitals, and building schools. Then wouldn't, and I think that we can probably both agree, I don't know, maybe not, that by attacking Iraq, which represented no threat to anybody, it was a secular state, they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, they weren't planning on attacking any other countries, Saddam Hussein was finishing up a novel, I mean, that's what he was working on, it's now in print. By attacking Iraq, what we have done is we have created a locus for terrorism in the world. You know, we have become the boogeyman. We have become the rallying point for radical Islam all over the world, and particularly in the Middle East. Don't those two simple realities demonstrate that the most crazy, insane, and stupid thing we could do is what you're advocating, which is attack another Islamic country, and instead the most sane and sensible thing we could do is to do the exact same thing that that Hamas and Hezbollah have done, win people's hearts and minds by building schools and hospitals and feeding people.
I completely disagree.
So why is it that attacking people will work for us, but it doesn't work for them? They've never done it. And feeding people will work for them, but it doesn't work for us, even though it's worked for us for the last 70 years.
Well, let's take each of those two in turn. The first one you said is they gain hearts and minds by building hospitals and schools. That is one tiny part of what they do. And they do win.
It's actually the largest part of their budget.
They do this stuff to prove their loyalty to Islam as a totalitarian system of government. They do it because they're proving their moral stature to the people who agree that Islam is the way to live. And
so why don't we prove our moral stature by saying that our capitalist society can feed people and we're going to share some of our largesse with you?
No, I don't think that's true. They don't win people because they do these hospitals. They win it because of the moral significance of that action, just as when they take on these terrorist operations, they do it in the name of Allah for the same cause under the same principle. It's different aspects of the same goal.
But the fact of the matter is, Ilan Jorno, that a lot of people in the Middle East, a lot of Muslims in the Middle East, disavow terrorism, but none of them disavow building hospitals, building schools, and feeding people.
I would like to hear from I take it you mean a large number. I'd like to hear from them when they disavow terrorism.
Look at what happened the week after 9/11. You had a candlelight vigil in the streets of Tehran, Iran, in solidarity with the United States. The public opinion polls that were done across the Middle East were universally showing that people in the Middle East were horrified by the possibility that 9/11 had been brought about by Muslims from the Middle East.
I don't buy that at all. You had a pocket in Iran, which I don't remember hearing about, and I looked for that. But you had people dancing and chanting, and you have Bin Laden on T-shirts and posters all over the Middle East. Now, he's a folk hero. That cannot.
This was after we attacked Afghanistan.
No, that's not true. He was a folk hero even before that. People went to Afghanistan because they admired him. He declared war on the United States in 1998.
And he was very marginalized. I mean, the maximum 20,000 people who were following this guy. We're talking about a billion people, the Muslims of the world.
Well, find me the Muslims who put up a moral objection to terrorism, and I'd like to talk to them. I think you can find people.
Well, they're running Indonesia. They're running Malaysia. They're running Pakistan.
They're running Pakistan, how is it that Pakistan is rife with terrorists who go in and out of Afghanistan and is a hiding place for terrorists?
So do you think we should attack Pakistan too? Ilan Jorno of the Ayn Rand Institute, ayn rand.org, do you think we should attack Pakistan as well?
I don't think it's a threat to us right now. Ultimately, we're talking about Iran because it's the most it's the one that's running to get nuclear weapons, boasting about it, and we're sending it, we're promising to send it money and
but we have demonstrated that if we name a country an axis of evil country, and if they don't actually have nuclear weapons and they don't actually have weapons of mass destruction, we will then conquer it, we will put its leaders in prison, we will destroy its people, we will wipe out its economy, and we'll steal its oil. We've demonstrated that. They watched us do that in Iraq. Doesn't it just make sense that they would want to have a nuclear weapon to deter us?
I don't think Iraq was the war that would prove anything to our enemies. If anything, it proves how weak we are, because Iraq was not the right target. It was not handled properly. and it is not a deterrent.
No, but my point is, I agree with you, and my point is that our invasion of Iraq is what is causing Iran to seek a nuclear weapon. And it's not because they're inherently hostile. They have, you know, in hundreds of years, they haven't attacked anybody. They keep getting attacked.
If they're not hostile, how do you account for the fact that they export terrorism and they oppress their own people? They're hostile to life, and they mean it when they say death to America.
You could say that of a dozen countries in the Middle East, Ilan Jorno.
But Iran is the ideological source of Islamic terrorism. It's proven that. It's proud of it.
I don't buy it. Saudi Arabia, you could convince me. But anyhow, interesting difference of opinion. AynRand.org, the website. 16 minutes past the hour. Ilan, thanks for being with us.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The White House thinks they did the job of Iraq. Iraq, they never heard of Johnny Saw of Iraq. Iraq, they care about what they went to find, and they give no part of those left behind. Bush will not be there when Johnny comes rolling.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, Tom Hartman here, the Tom Hartman radio program. Ilan Jorno is with us with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. I ask Ilan to stick around for another few minutes here. We have a couple of calls, callers who have questions for you. Ilan, you mind taking some calls?
No, I'd be happy to.
Okay, Scott in Virginia Beach, Virginia. You're live with Ilan Jorno of Ayn Rand.
Yes, I have a question for the gentleman. I just was curious what military service this gentleman had, and why does he keep saying we as far as attacking Iran?
I have not served in the military, but I admire our military. I think they're capable of doing an excellent job. And I speak we because I live in America, and I'm an American by choice. I love this country.
If you're not going to willing to give up your own life and maybe the life of your children, why are you sending other people to die?
I don't accept the premise of that question.
Excuse me? I was just wondering, you know, I was a mercenary for the first President Bush in Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and that's why I left the military. I was just wondering, what makes you think these people want to go out and attack these countries?
Well, as far as I know, we still have the freedom to join the army or not. And I agree with you. Sometimes the government chooses wars that are improper, and no one should be forced to serve in those. I don't agree with the Iraq war. But I think had we chosen Iran the first time, which is the arch enemy facing us, then there would have been fewer deaths, fewer casualties, and the war, so-called, on terrorism would have been over long ago. So,
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. Ilan, we know now that in 2003, this is in the Washington Post, that Iran offered to the Bush administration, quoting from Glenn Kessler's article in Sunday's Washington Post, it was a proposal from Iran for a broad dialogue with the United States. The facts suggested everything was on the table, including full cooperation on nuclear programs, acceptance of Israel, termination of Iranian support for Palestinian militant groups. Everything. Iran is willing to talk about everything. This was in 2003. But top Bush administration officials convinced the Iranian government was on the verge of collapse, belittled the initiative. Instead, they formally complained to the Swiss ambassador who had sent the facts with a cover letter certifying it was a genuine proposal supported by key power centers in Iran. They complained about it. Several former administration officials say the United States missed an opportunity in 2003 at a time when American strength was at its height and Iran did not have a functioning nuclear program or a gusher of oil revenue from soaring energy demand. We blew it. And now you think we should attack them?
I don't believe that offer for a minute. Iran does not speak the truth when it issues those kinds of things. I mean, if you look at the letter the president of Iran put out, it's a joke.
And I'm not, well, first of all, I actually did read that letter, and I didn't think it was a joke. I thought it was fascinating, but that's not the offer that we're talking about. This is from 3 years ago. 3 years ago.
I don't see any more reason to believe that offer than to believe that Iran will abide by any agreement to stop nuclear development.
But this is a country that has not attacked anybody. I mean, India has nuclear weapons. Israel has nuclear weapons. Pakistan has nuclear weapons.
Saying they've attacked nobody, but we keep coming back to this fact that they support terrorism. I mean, it's just war by a different means.
And you're suggesting that the amount of money that, by terrorism, you're talking about Hezbollah and Hamas, right?
Yeah. I mean,
okay. And who get most of their money actually from Saudi Arabia, from sources in Jordan, from the United Arab Emirates, even some money from the United States. Should we attack the United States?
I think that Iran is the arch ideological source which gives them the courage and gives them money to do these tasks.
Yeah. KJ in Camas, Washington, you're live with Alain Giorno at the Ayn Rand Institute.
Hi. First of all, a couple of things. First of all, and I've said this for the last 5 years, terrorism is not warfare. It is a criminal behavior and should have been treated like that all along. When you call it
warfare, as it was in the case of Tim McVeigh, for example.
Yeah, it should have been. I mean, we glorify it. When you call it warfare, glorify it. Now, that said, back in 1953, I believe it was the Eisenhower administration staged a coup against a democratically elected government in Iran. Was it Mossadegh?
Yeah, Mossadegh. It was the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, yeah.
Okay, and they took him down and reinstalled the Shah, who was a despot.
We just have a few seconds left. Alain, your response?
Yeah. I don't think terrorism is a criminal activity. It's usually, as we've seen in the last few years, used by forces funded by governments. And the way to stop it is not to prosecute them as criminals, but to take down the governments that sponsor terrorism.
But when those countries that do deal with terrorists as criminals, for example, Italy with the Red Brigades, when they even kidnapped Aldo Moro, the prime minister, killed a guy. Italy said, we're not going to declare war on these people. We're not going to dignify them with that. They're common criminals. We're going to take them out as criminals. It was very successful. The same thing with the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. The same thing with ETA in Spain. The same thing, to some extent, with the IRA in Ireland.
You have to take a look at what they're fighting for. And these people are fighting to impose Islamic totalitarianism across the world. That is the goal of Iran and Saudi Arabia, and those are the countries that are pushing this tactic on us in the West and threatening our lives. We have to do something about it.
Alain Giorno, ayanrand.org. Alain, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections in the United States. This is incredible. It's like the machine is running. We have had an unending stream here now on this program over the last, 6 months or so? Of people from former CIA operatives. We had Robert Baer on, the guy who they based the movie Syriana on, come on and say Iran is the biggest threat, you know, quack, 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 quack. You've got the Rove Cheney machine out there. You know, saying essentially the same thing, talking about Iran as this great big threat. You've got the Bush administration saying it. You've got the various right-wing think tanks saying it. And yet, according to the International Atomic Energy Commission, there's no hard evidence right now that Iran is actually trying to produce a nuclear weapon. They're enriching uranium. You have to enrich it to 3%. To fuel a nuclear power plant. We helped them build a nuclear power plant. They only have about 25 years worth of oil left. They figured, hey, you know, let's get some nuclear power going here. We are the ones who helped them build that. Back when it was our government, right, the Shah, our guy. And so they're saying, hey, you know, we got this uranium, let's enrich the stuff and put it in the nuclear power plant. Now, that's not to say that they're not going to enrich some of it beyond 3%, but you have to enrich it up into the 90s to make a nuclear bomb. And that's something that, according to the Pentagon estimates that I've seen, that have been made public, that we've all seen, could take them anywhere from 5 to 10 years. And they're operating, you know, they're using some old centrifuges that have to run 24/7 for 5 years to refine this stuff tightly enough to come up with uranium that's sufficiently concentrated in U-235 to actually be fissionable as a bomb. So I don't get it. Maybe I'm missing something here. And if you think so, you know, give us a call and let us know. Is it that Iran actually does represent some sort of a threat to the United States, or probably more directly to Israel, or to other countries in the region that are our allies? Does Iran represent a threat to Egypt, for example? Iran is not an Arab country. They have stood apart. They are Indo-Europeans. They refer to themselves as Persians. They're a Muslim country, but they're not an Arab country. They're not, at least by their definitions, they're not Semitic people. And they say, and they have stood apart from everybody else for forever, right? For a long, long time. And the Iranians are proclaiming, oh, this is just defensive stuff. We're just trying to be defensive. Now, yeah, they've got this guy running around who's the president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who, you know, denying the Holocaust. Come on, give me a break. And talking about Israel, whether or not, and again, there's different reports. Some people say he called for wiping Israel off the map. Other people say that's not what he called for. He was misquoted. He was saying something else to the effect of, you know, Israel shouldn't have as much land as it has, or something. Words that I don't, you know, again, I don't speak Persian. I don't speak Farsi. And I just, you know, the information coming out of this administration, I don't trust. We've been lied to before. You know, it's the old thing that Bush couldn't say, right? You know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on, or fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Not going to be fooled again. But here we had in 2003, apparently, whatever the reality is, in 2003, the Bush administration blew it big time. And again, why this isn't the lead story, I mean, this was on page 16 of the Sunday Washington Post, buried on page 16, this article by Glenn Kessler. Just after the lightning takeover of Baghdad by U.S. forces 3 years ago, an unusual two-page document spewed out of a fax machine at the Near East Bureau of the State Department. It was a proposal from Iran for a broad dialogue with the United States, and the fax suggested everything was on the table, including full cooperation on nuclear programs, acceptance of Israel, and the termination of Iranian support for Palestinian militant groups. The top Bush administration officials, convinced the Iranian government was on the verge of collapse, belittled the initiative. Instead, they formally complained to the Swiss ambassador who had sent the fax with a cover letter certifying it was a genuine proposal. They belittled this. Last month, the Bush administration abruptly shifted policy and agreed to join talks previously led by European countries over Iran's nuclear program, but several former administration officials say the United States missed an opportunity in 2003 at a time when American strength seemed at its height and Iran did not have a functioning nuclear program or a gusher of oil revenue from soaring energy demand. As Flint Leverett, senior director of the National Security Council staff at that time, who saw the Iranian proposal, said, at the time, the Iranians were not spinning centrifuges. They were not enriching uranium. It was a serious effort, a respectable effort, to lay out a comprehensive agenda for U.S.-Iranian rapprochement. While the Iranian approach has been previously reported, the actual document making the offer has surfaced only in recent weeks. The Washington Post confirmed its authenticity with both Iranian and former U.S. officials. Now, at the same time, now Bush is saying to the Iranians, you guys are going to have to change your nuclear policy. You're going to have to stop enriching uranium, or you're going to face sanctions. But the thing, now, you know, Bush talks really tough about saying, sanctions, yeah, we're going to get you. What isn't quoted so often is that the last time that there was a Bush discussion of sanctions, this was, what, 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, something like that, there was a little footnote. We're gonna slap sanctions on Iran on everything except their oil, which we need to buy. Yeah. Yeah. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Hassan in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Hassan.
How's it going, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'm calling in reference to a comment a caller had made a few minutes ago, claiming that basically all Arab and Muslim countries were out to spread totalitarianism across the world and basically take over all the countries and make people live the way that they want.
Well, what he said was that Iran was trying to do that specifically.
Yeah, well, that's not Iran's goal in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, if you look at the history of Iran, it doesn't seem like it would be. They've always kept within their borders. They've always pretty much said, hey, we're us. We're the Persians. Leave us alone.
Exactly. They just want to be able to do their own thing. And one of the things in the Muslim faith is you're not allowed to just attack a country. So all this talk about them developing nuclear weapons in order to, you know, spread terrorism and this and that and blah, 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 none of that is in line with the Muslim faith. Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure everybody knows, you know, Iran is very serious about their religion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this whole nuclear thing really is about energy, you know, spreading, having enough energy for their own country so they could sell off their oil and make more money, you know,
or
their people.
Or if they are trying to build a bomb, I think that you could probably very cogently argue that they're trying to do it for the same reason India and Pakistan did, and for the same reason Israel did, which is to use it as a defensive weapon, to use it as a threat against anybody who might think of invading them.
Exactly.
Including us.
If they were doing that, yeah, definitely. It would be an excellent defense mechanism. Everybody that has a nuclear weapon, you know, you don't see them being threatened, you know, to be invaded by you know, the U.S., by us, or by anyone else.
Right. I would submit to you that it is our behavior here in the world that has made the world far less stable, and we need to start acting according to the norms that were international standards of behavior before the Bushes came along. Hassan, thank you for your last point you wanted to make.
No, that's it. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Matt in El Dorado, California. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm going to nominate your last caller for Secretary of State.
Yeah, he was a rational voice.
Yes.
We need more.
Well, isn't it kind of nice, a little refreshing? Anyway, my point was that we're asking the wrong question, and Bush has allowed us to get into this, and the media is helping him do it, which is, are the countries like North Korea and Iran suicidal? Not are they aggressors, because any attack on us with a nuclear weapon is suicide.
You're right.
And if they attacked Israel,
that's,
you know,
suicide as well.
They're going to get rid of Israel. Yeah. 150 nuclear bombs against 10, who wins?
Right. Yeah.
So this is just a question of, are these people suicidal? And I don't believe they are. Their suicide bombers are fighting in a way that's just, it's hopeless, like the Japanese at the end of World War II.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't start out being suicide pilots.
Yeah. Well, actually, the kamikaze pilots, there's a whole interesting and elaborate thing that has to do with the religion of Japan at that time and emperor worship. But setting that aside, you're right. That's a very, very important question. Matt, thank you very much for that. Bob in Danbury, Connecticut. Hey, Bob, we just have a half a minute or so before we've got to take a break. A quick one?
Oh, I'll give you a real quickie. I just came back from Israel. I was there with a group of people, and we had an opportunity to meet with somebody from the government, just, you know, to talk and to welcome us.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of Iran and having a nuclear weapon. And basically what he told us was, take my words for fact, Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. So I think that Israel knows whether Iran has a nuclear weapon or is close to a nuclear weapon.
And they'll stop it the same way they stopped Saddam back 15, 20 years ago.
The ones who got rid of the nuclear stuff.
Yeah.
They will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon next door to them. And what he said was, we learned a lesson with Hitler when he said, we're going to wipe you off the face of the earth. Nobody believed it.
Yeah.
And they don't feel that way about Iran. Iran said that, and Iran will never, you can go to the bank, will never have a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
And Israel will know about it way before we do.
Bob, good point, and I believe you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tax cuts, tax cuts, made to give folks a break. What the Fed gives, to take, but that is not my department. Sell the house, rent an apartment, and you'll be flush, and you can rush to praise tax cuts I give to you. That's right, to you, all the little, all you fellow Americans out
there. And your children and grandchildren will pay for them, because there aren't really tax cuts. They're really tax deferrals. They're borrowing from future generations, borrowing money right now, and they will have to be paid as taxes later. George W. Bush has not cut any taxes at all. He has raised taxes. It's just he hasn't raised taxes on this generation. He's raised taxes on this generation's children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. We ought to just tell the truth about it. Jeff in Denver, Colorado, on the line with us. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Well, it's interesting when you look at the criteria for terrorism that, there's one country right
following
now.
Following up on our conversation about Iran?
Yeah. And all the criteria they're talking about why Iran is dangerous. Well, it's like you're talking, they're talking about spreading danger around the world and such. Well, there's one country that's invaded other countries. It has more nukes than anybody. It's the only country that's ever used nukes. It spread nukes all over the place. It supports oppressive regimes, dictators, and so forth. It supported insurgencies such as in Central America. It's overthrown more governments on Asia, Africa.
It just supported the warlords in Somalia that took down the Black Hawk helicopter.
Yeah, and some of these things, it's invaded other countries in recent years. It's supported the coup in Haiti in recent years. And even right now, it's housing a terrorist, Luis Posada Corrales, who blew up a jetliner.
Boy, it's been a long time since we've heard about him, isn't it?
Well, actually, some of the news, Democracy Now! Reports on him occasionally and so forth.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's us. So it's like, if you look, just objectively by the facts, we have done more than anybody.
And yet, I really don't think that any Americans, and I don't think at any level of honesty, Jeff, you or I would characterize the United States as a terrorist nation.
Yeah.
So what we're saying then is that, number one, we've got a foreign policy that we need to clean up. We've engaged in some activities, particularly what's going on in Guantanamo and what happened in Iraq, that are just horrific. They spit in the face of the founders of this country, the Bush administration activities. But that doesn't make Americans terrorists.
Well, what has happened with all this is these things, such as, say, 1953 in Iran, that's our blowback. All these things, Osama bin Laden, we helped to train him, and then we abandoned the Mujahideen and so forth. And so over and over again, it's blowback from what we did earlier. So the thing is, we need to stop doing that now and start, actually, as you said, educating, building schools
and
so forth.
Avoid future blowback.
Yeah, we used to be really admired in the Middle East. There were the American universities all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And everybody wanted to come to the United States to be educated.
Yes.
Now they're going to Oxford.
Yeah, and if you look at it, one of the reasons the Middle Eastern peoples didn't stand out so much before is because they blended in more with society. I mean, look at people like Ralph Nader. He's of Lebanese descent and so forth. We found all sorts of Middle Eastern people. But they came into our culture because they admired our culture.
Yeah, John Zogby's father.
Mm-hmm.
And on it goes. Good point. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call.
You're welcome.
Amazing. 54 minutes past the hour. According to an Agence France-Presse report, the former chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Hans Blix, said today, June 20th, Tuesday, the talks on Iran's controversial nuclear program appear to be progressing. Again, we should attack, therefore? The Swedish diplomat told a press conference after meeting Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, the negotiation looks better and brighter now than it was half a year ago. Blix was in Indonesia to present the president of Indonesia with a report on the world's nuclear, biological, and chemical arms, which he wrote with a team of experts put together by Sweden back in September of 2003. He's already presented the report, which generally decries the stagnation of global nuclear disarmament efforts to a series of world leaders, beginning with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on June 1st. Blix said that it would be wise for Iran to stop enriching uranium. However, he also said they have the right to enrich uranium, but they're not obliged to. So he said it's a matter of negotiations. And they go on to note, Tehran insists that its nuclear program is aimed solely at generating electricity and denies U.S. charges that it seeks nuclear weapons. The U.S., along with Britain, France, Germany, and China, have made Iran's suspension of uranium enrichment a major, what would you call it, a major big deal effort. So now at the same time over in North Korea, they're getting ready to fire missiles. It's like, you know, what's going on? And then we get back to our image around the world. And this is the part that really concerns me the most. For example, this is the Andrew Sullivan's blog. Andrew Sullivan, what really happened at Gitmo, he says. The truth is, none of us really knows. He goes on, here's a list of interrogation techniques reliably documented at U.S. detention centers in Guantanamo or Afghanistan, compiled by Stephen Miles, who's a medical ethicist, in a forthcoming book, Oath Betrayed. He sources this out of 35,000 pages of government documents or credible witness testimony that he obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. These are the things that we have been documented to have done or continuing to do as part of our interrogation techniques in Guantanamo Bay and in other prisons around the world. Quote, beatings, punching with fist, use of truncheons, kicking, slamming against walls, stretching or suspension to tear ligaments or muscles or to cause asphyxia, external electric shocks, forced renunciation of religion, false confessions or accusations, applying urine and feces to prisoners, inducing hypothermia and exposure to extreme heat, use of sedatives, mock executions, water immersion, obstructing the prisoner's airway, chest compression, rape, thermal burning, dog bites, sexual abuse, and forcing a prisoner to watch the abuse or torture of a loved one. We are doing this right now, as Andrew Sullivan documents. It's time for us to change this regime.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ben Barnes is with us. He is the former Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives. He has a new book out. It's called Barn Burning, Barn Building. The website, barnburningbarnbuilding.com, as you may appropriately guess. The subtitle, Tales of a Political Life from LBJ to George W. Bush and Beyond. Ben Barnes, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you, Tom. I'm delighted to be on your show.
We're very pleased to have you with us here. Ben Barnes, former Speaker of the House for the state of Texas. Ben, you're probably most famous or infamous these days outside of Texas as the guy who gave the pass to George W. Bush back during the Vietnam War.
Yes, that's right, Tom. I got asked by a family friend of the Bush family to make a call to move President Bush up the line, so to speak, up the list of people who were on the waiting list to go in the Texas Air National Guard in 1968 when I was Speaker of the House and had just been nominated Lieutenant Governor. And he got into the National Guard, and I said in 2004 during the campaign that I was not very proud of myself for having done that, but it wasn't about George Bush. It was about the literally dozens of other young men that I got in the National Guard, and it wasn't the fact that they didn't want to go to the Vietnam War. That I didn't hold that against them. The fact was I should not have had that much power as a young 28-year-old to decide who was going to go to Vietnam and who was not going to go. And so I'm ashamed of the fact that I did those things and that I had that power and that I was really kind of overcome that with the fact that a young man should not have that kind of power, or an old man either. I don't think politicians should decide who go to war.
Well, isn't this really, Ben Barnes, in a way, the modern incarnation, and we have it going on today as well, I suppose, in many different ways, but isn't the modern incarnation of the old system that we had in the late 19th century even during the Civil War, in fact, where you could pay to have somebody serve in your stead during time of draft.
Well, that's exactly right. And if you recall, Tom, in Vietnam, there were literally thousands of people in the street protesting against the war, and it became increasingly more unpopular. Hundreds of young men went to Canada to keep them serving. But there's no doubt about it. The people who had families that were politically connected and to state office holders, because the state legislatures and the state governors are over the state National Guards, and so they had the influence to allow various and sundry young men to go into their National Guard and the Army National Guard and not have to go to Vietnam.
It's not my job to give you absolution or anything, Ben Barnes, but I would certainly say, you know, you were part of a system and you did what the system expected at the time. I mean, at the time, I'm assuming that it probably seemed that way to you.
Well, it seemed that way, but it was in 2002 or 2003. I was showing a couple of members of the British Parliament the Vietnam Memorial, and it was one night about 9 o'clock. The dusk had just fallen, and the lights and the shadows were shining on those names on the Vietnam Memorial, and I'd never really thought about it until that night. And when I saw those names of those young men who died in Vietnam, I was just overcome with the fact that I should not have had that power, and I did the wrong thing. And so that's why I talked about it in 2004. And I chose not to talk about it when George Bush ran for governor twice and for president the first time. But when I saw the Swift Boat ads being run against John Kerry, who had served, who volunteered to go to Vietnam and had served, I said, hey, wait, this is unfair. I was asked a question. I didn't know it was going to be on television. I was asked a question at a meeting in Austin, and I answered it as I answered it on your show, and then I had an opportunity to go on 60 Minutes. They already had the film clip of me in a pair of shorts giving that answer, and so I went on Dan Rather's show, and what I said was exactly what I said to you. I made the call. I wasn't judgmental. I'm sorry I did it, and that was it.
How did you feel? Well, first of all, when you were lieutenant governor of Texas, I'm guessing by the time George W. Bush stopped showing up for his National Guard duty.
Yes, that's right.
And
in 1970.
Right, and as such, you were the number two officer in the executive branch of the state that. The executive branch of which is responsible for the Air National Guard in that state. Is that am I
correct? That's exactly right.
So you were in a way the boss probably closest to the ground there, or the boss of the Texas Air National Guard. Did you know that George W. Bush had stopped showing up?
No, I didn't, because if you recall, Tom, what happened was George Bush transferred to the Alabama National Guard. He
right.
transferred to Alabama to work for a campaign for a gentleman who was running for the United States Senate in Alabama, so he left the Texas Air National Guard. It would have been called to my attention if he'd been in Texas, but, you know, the sad thing about the Bush Guard deal is not that he got in the Guard. The real serious thing about what happened was, and it's all past history now, but he didn't fulfill his contract, because you have to go to Guard meetings, and if you miss three Guard meetings, then you were automatically shipped to Vietnam, and they can find no record of him going on the Air National Guard base in Alabama, except one time maybe to get to keep a dental appointment. So the hundreds of thousands of dollars went into training someone to be a pilot, and to the best of my knowledge, George Bush is one of the few people that ever gave up his pilot's license. As you well know, most people are very proud of their pilot's license, and they're certainly happy to go take physicals to keep their pilot's license in effect, and George Bush wouldn't take a physical sometime that summer and lost his pilot's license.
Yeah, I well know it, speaking as a licensed private pilot myself.
Well, you know then the ego that is attached with those pilot's licenses, Tom.
I do well. We're talking with Ben Barnes, the former lieutenant governor, the former speaker of the Texas House of Representatives. He's the author of a new book, Barn Burning, Barn Building, the website barnburningbarnbuilding.com. Ben, this discussion of George W. Bush is just a very small part of your book. It's a fascinating story from John Connally through Richard Nixon. Nixon's dirty tricks in Texas, for example. Tell us about this.
Well, in 1971, Richard Nixon sent federal investigators to Texas to try to find something negative about me to try to end my political career, and he was successful in doing that. President Johnson had said a lot of very embarrassing and very kind things about me about a dinner where he said that someday I was going to be the next president of the United States from Texas. I had been
by embarrassing, you mean overly flattering?
Yes, overly flattering. Yeah. Uh-huh. At political dinners, Tom, every speaker is invited to political dinners based on how many flattering things they can say about the incumbent who's being honored or the candidate that's being honored. Okay. And I've said many flattering things too that might not have necessarily could be proven true in a courtroom about people that I was trying to help. But Johnson said that, and I had been Humphrey's campaign manager in Texas in 1968 when Richard Nixon lost Texas, and he lost the popular vote. He beat Hubert Humphrey by electoral votes and not by the popular vote, as we saw Al Gore and George Bush in 2000. Well, anyway, it was a real source of concern of President Nixon, and if you can go to my website that you talked about, burningbarnbuilding.com, and you can actually hear President Nixon talking to Attorney General Mitchell, and the Attorney General is saying, well, Mr. President, it's very good in Texas. We've got the Democrats caught in the scandal. We've got the governor and the Speaker of the House and the chairman of the party. They're all involved with this banker and insurance company. The gentleman, it looks like it's very bad for him. It looks like we can blow him out of the water. And he goes down the line listing all of this, and then you can hear Nixon's voice very plain. But he says, what about Barnes? And the Attorney General says, well, Ben Barnes was not involved. We can't find out any way that he's involved or that he even knew this guy. Mitchell said, I don't care. He's got to know something about something. There's got to be some things that we can drag out that's going to embarrass Barnes. And I want Barnes. I don't care about the rest of them. Well, it's pretty chilling. Matter of fact, it still causes chills to go up and down my spine to hear the President of the United States say, look, I don't want the rest of them. I want Barnes. And so
we're going to take this guy out. This is like the mafia.
That's right. It was. It was kind of you know, like a chieftain, the mafia chieftain saying, go get him and take him out. Well, they were successful in doing that. And it's very funny. Back in 1960, I met Sam Rayburn for the first time, the Speaker of the House, and I was riding in a car with him. Matter of fact, I was driving. It was during a rainstorm, and he accidentally got in my car, and there I was with the Speaker of the House, and I didn't know what to say to him. I had not even taken the oath of office. I was a newly elected state representative at the ripe old age of 22, and so I trying to grasp for words to make up a conversation. So I said, Mr. Speaker, what kind of president do you think John Kennedy is going to make? John Kennedy was just appointing his cabinet about to take office. And he said, well, I think he'll do all right. He said, I wish he was appointing more people who'd run for sheriff to his cabinet, wanting some more people that maybe had run for office. But he said, he turned in the car and grabbed my left leg and said, young man, it's not important that Jack Kennedy got elected. It's important that Richard Nixon got defeated. And I'll tell you, he'll try to come back. And you're a young man. I won't be here, but you'll be here. You got to promise me you're going to do everything you can to keep him from making a political comeback, because if he does, he may well destroy the office of the presidency. Well, that was in 1960. In 1972 and 3, we saw what happened. Nixon almost did destroy the office of the presidency.
He was prescient. Well, you can read the whole story over at barnburningbarnbuilding.com, the book, a new book by Ben Barnes. And Ben Barnes, thanks so much for being with us,
Tom,
today.
Great to be on the Tom Hartman Show. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And sharing your marvelous stories. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been working on vacation all the summer long, doing some intense relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell. Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam. Roberts is supreme. My revenge for Bork. Someone's been removing some brushweed. That someone is me. Someone's been removing some brushweed. The burden of the presidency.
There you go. Welcome back. That was just a good one. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. George W. Bush, he's out there twice to a crowd. He's talking to political supporters last night, right? George W. Bush. twice, he's given a speech, and he's talking about how you have to vote to keep Bill Frist in the Senate. And I quote, "If you want to keep your taxes low, keep Denny Hastert and Bill Frist as leaders of the House and Senate. I want to thank you for helping make sure that Denny Hastert and Bill Frist remain in their positions in the Senate and House. I assure you this, we will continue to lead this country with an optimistic, hopeful, positive vision that says that every American opportunity belongs to you as much as your neighbor. Or at least belongs to me as much as, in any case. Only problem, Bill Frist is retiring." But that doesn't stop George Bush from campaigning for him. By the way, on this day in history, on June 20th, 1979, the first solar energy system was installed at the White House. This from the HistoryChannel.com. President Jimmy Carter and First Lady Rosalynn Carter climbed to the White House on this day in history to celebrate the installation of solar energy panels there in 1979. The system consisted of 32 photovoltaic panels that generated enough energy to provide hot water for the entire White House. During his term, Carter also had energy-efficient wood-burning stoves installed in the drafty White House residential quarters. The HistoryChannel.com goes on to note that President Reagan had the solar panels removed and put in a federal storage facility in Virginia, stating that the energy crisis that had affected both foreign and domestic policy during Carter's term would not be a factor during his own term. Isn't that special? So, Reagan, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And as you may have heard on the news, this is totally strange. The Pentagon, 30 years after the American Psychiatric Association, has ceased to classify homosexuality as a mental disorder, and in fact has said, hey, it's part of the spectrum of normal. It's not in the DSM any longer, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. 30 years later, the Pentagon comes out and says, oh, no, homosexuality, a mental disorder. Like, you know, this paragon of mental health, right? The Pentagon, they have come up with this. At the same time, the newly elected bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, said on Monday that not only does she not believe that homosexuality is a disorder, she says it's not even a sin, that gays were created by God to love people of the same gender. She was elected on Sunday as the first woman leader of the 2.3 million member Episcopal Church, which is the U.S. branch of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that this is the church that was, you know, the official Church of England that was formed back when King Henry VIII decided to split with the Pope, with the Catholic Church. I am not an Anglican, so I can't speak authoritatively about that. In the Worldwide Anglican Church, women are bishops only in Canada, the United States, and New Zealand. She also supported the consecration of Gene Robinson in New Hampshire, the first openly gay bishop in more than 450 years of Anglican history. And she's married to her husband, Richard Shorey, who is a retired theoretical mathematician. They have one daughter who is a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force and, like her mother, a pilot. When asked about the Bible condemning homosexuality, at least in the Old Testament, Jesus never condemned homosexuality. She says the Bible was written in a very different historical context by people asking different questions. Here's her exact quote. She says, "The Bible has a great deal to teach us about how to live as human beings. It does not have so much to teach us about what sorts of food to eat, what sorts of clothes to wear. There are rules in the Bible about those things that we don't observe today." And she's right. You know, the Bible says you can't wear clothing made out of two different fabrics. So, you can't eat shellfish. Well, you know, some people actually still observe some of those rules, many of those rules. The Bible says that if children dishonor or disrespect their parents, they should be stoned to death. I don't know anybody who argues that that should be the law. Maybe Judge Moore does. I don't know. The Ten Commandments judge wants to bring them back. Who knows? Terry in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind here?
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about what the problem is.
Terry, I've got to interrupt you, and I'm going to have to put you on hold here. We just, I got caught by a break I wasn't expecting. I'm sorry, but we have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour, 27 minutes past the hour. So we will be back with our conversation with Terry in just a moment. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, talk radio for the rest of us.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we were talking with Terry in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Terry, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. I'm back. There's been a lot of talk about what the problems are in our country right now, and there's certainly a lot of them. But there hasn't been a whole lot of talk about a possible solution. And, you know, I know that we're a lot of people are hanging their hopes on the outcome of the midterm elections in November. Of course, we have to worry about the legitimacy of those elections, unfortunately. That's sad to say, but that's where we are when, you know, when you look at the black box voting problems and the Choice Point scandal. There's another option, and that is the state-initiated impeachment. And there's been some talk about, in many of the states, actually.
Yeah, this is the Jefferson's Rules strategy. Thomas Jefferson wrote a set of basically kind of a rule book for how the House of Representatives should run. And it suggests that individual states can bring impeachment actions at the federal level. It's not in the Constitution, but it's not excluded by the Constitution.
Exactly. And one of the reasons, I think it's clear that Jefferson made that rule to protect us from the situation we're in now, where you have a president whose party controls both houses, and that they're not, doing their job. They're not providing oversight, and that's where we are right now. I live in Massachusetts, and as far as the Massachusetts state legislature is concerned, they have 200 members. Of those 200 members, 173 are Democrats, only 27 Republicans. I emailed Massachusetts State Senator Stan Rosenberg, who was recuperating from heart surgery, actually, and I wish him a speedy recovery, but he was kind enough to return that email and told me that it would require a 4/5 vote jointly.
Mm-hmm.
So if my math is correct, that means that it would require 160 members to vote affirmative.
Right.
Which means that even if not one Republican in the Massachusetts state legislature was willing to, uphold their oath and defend the Constitution. And even if 12 Democrats, for some reason, didn't want to support this, it would still be 4/5. But I think the problem is because this would be incredibly historic, unprecedented. I believe it's never happened. There would have to be a real will, and in the absence of, a lot of pressure from not only Massachusetts constituents, but also from the rest of the country saying, we don't want to hang our hopes exclusively on November.
It's going to have to come from the people up.
Absolutely.
And in Massachusetts, if you're talking about the state legislature, it's really going to have to come from the residents of Massachusetts.
And, I think that a lot of people just aren't aware that this is a possibility.
Yeah.
And a lot of
we're not even sure that it is a possibility, Terry. We know that the articles can be introduced this way. I mean, right now the Republicans are preventing articles of impeachment from even being introduced or discussed on the floor of the House. But whether the states could carry a vote,
right?
I mean, that's this is huge unknown territory.
Right.
A quick question for you, Terry. How is it that you have a legislature that is 4/5 Democratic, and your state elected a Republican as governor?
That is really a very interesting question, and I don't know. I think Mitt Romney's got his sights set on 2008, and he has a fairly low approval rating in Massachusetts. It's under 40 last time I looked, and I just don't know how that worked out. But what I wanted
Does he have a relative? Is he related to Chuck Hagel, who used to run the voting machine company ES&S or something?
You always have to wonder. But I know he's got a pretty close relationship, from what I've heard, with President Bush, and he does have business dealings, I've heard, that involve the Carlyle Group. So that's kind of an interesting thing. But I wanted to tell you also, under Section 603, is I understand this rule, that included in those rules, if that happens, if the state legislature does initiate impeachment, it has to be dealt with right away before any other business can be done in the U.S. Congress.
Right.
So that's pretty interesting.
But see, here's, again, we're back to the problem of, let's say Massachusetts said, okay, we're going to vote to impeach Bush.
Right.
And therefore, the Massachusetts delegation was obligated to bring that before the House of Representatives. Benny Hastert says, okay, all in favor, a few Democrats raised their hand, all opposed, all the Republicans raised their hand, they control the House, end of vote.
This is what I have to say about that. I think that the nature of this country was built on people who were up for long shots. You had a bunch of farmers who were up against the most powerful empire in the world.
Oh, no, Terry, I understand and I agree with you. I'm not arguing that you shouldn't be lobbying your legislators to push for impeachment of Bush through the Jefferson rule book, through the state level. And it's happening in a number of states. It's happening in Vermont, the state I used to live in.
Yeah.
It's there's discussion of it here in Oregon, the state I live in right now. I know that there's discussion of it in Massachusetts. It's in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, there's been discussion. A number of states are talking about this, and there's some fairly lively discussions going on. And most political observers are very skeptical about the possibility of it ever happening, but I think it's a good conversation to have. And it is, like you say, it's an incredible long shot, and wouldn't it be incredible? No, I'm not shooting it down at all. I'm just I'm not one of those people who says, oh, let's not talk about impeachment. Let's instead focus our effort on getting local Democrats elected and getting national Democrats elected. I'm one of those folks who actually believes that Democrats can chew gum and walk at the same time, that we are capable of doing more than one thing at the same time.
Absolutely. And another thing is that wouldn't it be nice to, if it were at all possible, to have an investigation into the laundry list of offenses before the November election so people could be more informed, better informed.
And this is where it really needs to begin. Terry, I've got to move along, but thank you for the call and thank you for your activism on this and other issues. This is just, it's absolutely great. Speaking of who needs to be impeached, this is, people say, if you impeach Bush, you just get Cheney. Well, no, you impeach them both, first of all. And secondly, if you impeach Bush and Cheney, then you've got Demi Hastert. No, I'm sorry. If you impeach Bush and Cheney, it means that you had Democrats in control of the House and Senate, and then you get Nancy Pelosi or whoever replaces her. So that's not all that bad a thing. Dick Cheney here, now taking questions to the National Press Club.
About a year ago, you said that the insurgency in Iraq was in its final throes. Do you still believe this?
I do. What I was referring to was the series of events that took place in 1995.
And there he's talking about the elections. And, first of all, that's not what he was referring to. He was very explicit at the time. And secondly, the insurgency is going to be in its final throes when we leave, because they are insurgents against the occupation of Iraq. These are people who are standing up and saying, hey, you're occupying our country. We don't want you to be occupying our country. Thank you very much. Hit the road, Jack. And instead, what they're hearing back from us is this blustery kind of nonsense coming out of the mouths of people like Bill O'Reilly.
I shoot you right between the eyes. Okay? That's how I run that country, just like Saddam ran it. Saddam didn't have explosions. He didn't have bombers, did he? Because if you got out of line, you're dead.
There you go. Bill O'Reilly.
I shoot you right between the eyes.
And boy, is he excited about that, So the Iraqis are going, hey, wait a minute. You guys are occupying our country. You're blowing up our buildings. We still don't have water. We still don't have electricity. You're taking our oil. You won't hire us. You won't give us jobs. What construction you're doing in the country, you're bringing in foreign companies and foreign contractors to do. You won't even give us. We have 50% unemployment. We're not having it. And thus we have an insurgency. An insurgency is by definition, how is it that the American people have missed this? An insurgency is what you have by definition when an occupied people rise up against their occupiers. It's called an insurgency. It's not a war. It's an insurgency. And Dick Cheney all but admitting it. All but admitted it. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. While the Busby campaign issues continue, I know a friend of mine, Amy, who calls into the show, also went out last night to a meeting where we're going to ask for a hand recount to register our voters.
We're talking about Francine Busby, the woman who was running as a Democrat to replace Duke Cunningham, the disgraced Republican, who lost by some 4,500 votes, according to the official count, to a Republican, in large part, according to the political pundits, because she made the mistake of saying to a Hispanic group, you don't need papers to vote in the election.
Well, yeah, that was what they're saying. We're kind of questioning here because the independent and the libertarian got an inordinate number of votes in this district, mm-hmm. which was kind of strange to us. And so coupled with the voting machines being taken home by the precinct volunteers as much as 2 weeks in advance causes us all to question the validity of the election.
So you guys are asking for a hand recount because these were optical scanned ballots.
Exactly.
Is there any possibility of that happening, Scott?
I haven't heard yet. They're making a formal petition. There is something going around the web right now for this and asking people to sign in this area. I'm not sure how far it's going to go yet. I'll have more details as we go. But from right now, we're demanding a hand recount of all the optical scanned ballots.
Yeah, okay. Well, I wish you well. I wish you good luck on that.
One more thing?
Sure.
Net neutrality, I want to discuss that very quickly. I've been on the Internet since before it was really the Internet. What's happening right now, I'll be very brief. The cable modems are probably one of the biggest profit centers for any cable provider in the world. It's all built on public infrastructure. They're just putting nodes on what's already existing.
Yeah, you know, I got it, Scott. And I thought we talked about that at some length yesterday. Yeah, I might be mixing up my radio shows, but yeah, we did. Okay, so and we got to take a break. But Scott, thanks for the call and for the point well made. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day. Here's Tom Hartman.
I'm sorry for the.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Bill O'Reilly on a rant. Show me the evidence of the torture.
If you're going to tell me there's torture going on, I want to see the torture. I see some evidence of the torture.
He wants to see it. He wants to see it. Well, I recall the photo of that guy's body on ice there were several of them. Frankly, you could argue, all you have to do is go look at the morgues in Iraq immediately after the invasion and up until now. But the bottom line reality is, I mean, this is the exact same propaganda that came out of the Soviet Union when we were charging that the Soviet Union was torturing people and that they were using, that they had gulags and that they were using psychiatric facilities. They said, hey, prove it. Show us somebody. Well, it's there at the gulag 40 miles south of Kaliningrad. You can't go in that facility. But if we go in that facility, we can show you the torture. But you can't go in that facility. Do you get the catch-22 here of the Reich saying, oh, we've got no torture? Prove it to me. And we say, okay, fine, yeah, let us talk to the people we think you tortured. No, you can't talk to them. 35,000 pages. Stephen Miles. Stephen Miles, he has a book coming out called Oath Betrayed. Andrew Sullivan blogging about this. 35,000 pages that he obtained from the federal government under Freedom of Information Act lawsuits. And based on that, and on credible witness testimony, he says that he has over 100 human beings who died as a consequence of torture in the hands of the United States. As the Washington Post wrote day before yesterday, quote, "This political and administrative mess stems directly from Mr. Bush's decision in the weeks after 9/11 to take extraordinary measures against terrorism through the assertion of presidential power rather than through legislation, court action, or diplomacy. His intent was to exclude Congress, the courts, and other governments from influencing or even monitoring how foreign detainees were treated. Senior officials led by Vice President Cheney argue that this policy would give the administration the flexibility it needed to fight the war effectively. Instead, it has done the opposite. Mr. Bush's policies have deeply tarnished U.S. prestige abroad, inhibited cooperation with allies, and prevented justice for al-Qaeda." And you say, what? Did he just say justice for al-Qaeda? Yes, we provided justice to the Nazis after World War II. You remember the Nuremberg trials? It would have been so easy. It would have been so easy after World War II to simply say, okay, we've got these 200 guys here, and we know that they were running death camps. We know that they were killing people. We know that they're the worst of the worst. Line them up against the wall. Or just disappear them. Put them in a prison where they just never see the light of day again. We certainly could have done that. The Soviets did that with the people that they had in their under their control. They just disappeared. They vanished them. They killed them or they vanished them. But we said, Harry Truman said after the end of World War II, he said, we are the United States. We set the moral tone for the world. We are not going to behave like the Nazis. When we prosecute the Nazis, we're going to behave like Americans. We're going to take, if it takes years, we're going to have trials for these people. They're going to be public trials. They're each going to have a lawyer. They're going to have a full defense. They're going to have an opportunity to subpoena witnesses. They are going to have the ability to have a fair trial, the same as we want, the same as we would want for any of our citizens, the same as we think the entire world should have. We are going to set an example for the world. And we so successfully set that example for the world in the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II that the International Court, the International Tribunal in The Hague, the International Appeals Court, and to a large extent the United Nations itself, as an international body, as a body to which people can countries can appeal as a place of last resort, came about. And was empowered. We established the high moral tone that led to the end of the Soviet Union. 35,000 pages here, Stephen Miles has found, citing that the United States has killed over 100 human beings in the process of interrogating them using techniques that include, and I quote, these are from federal government documents, and I quote, beating, punching with fists, use of truncheons, kicking, stretching or suspension to tear ligaments or muscles to cause asphyxia, external electric shocks, forcing prisoners to abase and to urinate on themselves, forced renunciation of religion, false confessions or accusations, applying urine and feces to prisoners, making verbal threats to a prisoner and his family, denigrating to a prisoner's religion, force feeding, induced hypothermia and exposure to extreme heat, dietary manipulation, use of drugs, extreme sleep deprivation, mock executions, water immersion, waterboarding, obstruction of the prisoner's airways, chest compression, thermal burning, rape. We are using rape as a torture as an interrogation technique. Dog bites, sexual abuse, forcing a prisoner to watch the abuse or torture of a loved one, done by the United States. And we wonder why the world is not treating our soldiers well when they take them. We wonder why the insurgents think that they can behave the way that they perceive we have. It's time for the United States to take back some moral authority. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day, Thomas Jefferson, 1791. I would rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending to too much liberty than to those attending to too small a degree of it. Time for our Bioneers segment for the week. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.com, their website. Brian Halwile is the senior researcher at the World Watch Institute and our Bioneer for the day. Hey, Brian.
Hey there, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Am I pronouncing your last name right, Brian?
Yes, it's Halwile.
Halwile. Thank you very much. Brian, the World Watch Institute, tell me, you know, what's up there right now? What are you guys doing?
Well, World Watch is one of the world's first environmental research groups. It was started in 1974, and we try to change the world with information. We publish reports and articles and give talks on sort of the world's most important environmental challenges, but we don't just describe the problems. We point to solutions. We point to the communities and the corporations and the countries that are doing things that we think the rest of the world should know about and replicate. A country that's doing something innovative to support solar energy or organic farming or improve public health among the poor.
And for years you've been publishing these State of the World pieces that are very good.
Exactly. It's our sort of flagship publication. It's used in tens of thousands of universities in this country and around the world. Lately we have been doing a lot of work on both renewable energy but also sort of redefining the food system.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, Brian. You have written about or been involved with, fill me in here, I believe it's your latest book, Eat Here, about a local food movement that is growing across the United States. And you're suggesting, if I have this right, you're suggesting that localizing our food supply is not only healthier and not only less expensive, but also one of the keys to having an economy that works and to recreating a culture that works.
You summarized it very nicely, Tom. I think that eating local is the most inspiring and encouraging change in the American diet today, because finally it gives Americans a reason to be curious about their food, and not just the number of calories or grams of carbs that their food contains, but how their food was produced, who produced it, where it was produced, and that interest is going to begin to shine a light on all of those aspects of our food system that have become problematic, whether it's the abundance of junk food or the mistreatment of farm workers, the mistreatment of farm animals, or the use of pesticides and other pollutants. And the good news is that this isn't a movement about something negative or sort of, you know, marching in the streets in the rain. This is a way of eating that ends up generating not just jobs and money for local economies, not just some sort of livelihood for rural areas, but it's the easiest way to eat healthier, and ultimately, the fresher the food is, the more local it is, the better it tastes.
Now, Brian Halwell, senior researcher at the Worldwide Institute, author, Eat Here, the factory farm industry, the Monsantos of the world, the ADMs of the world, would say to you, "Oh, come on, we've got a couple hundred million people in the United States. We need to feed them. We've got these great big factory farms. We're cranking out food like nobody's business. If everybody went to this kind of local, small scale, organic stuff, you'd have people starving."
Well, those are some important myths that you just pointed to. First of all, it's important to make this disclaimer that I'm not talking about 100% self-sufficiency. A certain amount of food trade and food shipping has been done for a very long time. The Romans depended on food coming from all around the known world at the time. Native Americans traded between South America and North America. And a certain amount of food trade is a very natural and beneficial, particularly for items, spices and coffee and chocolate that we, in our case in America, can't grow here. But there is also a certain amount of food trade that is incredibly wasteful and wholly unnecessary. And so, you know, while the proponent of the existing food system might say, well, the reason it exists is because it's incredibly efficient and it's the only way we're going to feed the world, well, it's only efficient when you look at it in a very narrow, from a very narrow point of view. It's efficient because we're not including the tremendous amount of petroleum and energy used to shuttle food around the planet. We're not looking at the cost to local communities who lose their local market, and then ultimately the farmland gets paved over and farmers go out of business. And we're not including the other sorts of costs that we don't really see when we go to the checkout counter, which is another great advantage of eating local, is it gives you that intimate connection to your food. You're able to ask the farmer or the food maker anything you want to know about that food, and it's probably the best way to get people interested in their local environment. And I know this is controversial. It's sort of moving in the complete opposite direction of free food trade, but that's exactly what's propelling this movement, is more and more people are dissatisfied with that factory farming model.
Wouldn't it be accurate to say also that factory farming is not efficient and is not economical if you consider the cost of one out of every three Americans getting cancer, and many of those cancers being a consequence of the industrial chemicals that are used in our foods, that we have widespread nutritional deficiencies in the United States? We've recently, probably the most obvious example is the recent discovery that I don't want to call it an epidemic, but the large number of children born with spina bifida or bifida, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, is simply the result of a B vitamin deficiency.
Right.
Because their mothers were eating basically nothing but processed food during their pregnancies, and now they're saying, you know, give them a little folic acid and everything will be fine. I mean, this is you know, basically folate. That's green stuff.
Right.
I mean, that if you look at the social costs, not, you know, plus, and you mentioned petroleum in terms of transportation, but also most of your fertilizers and most of your pesticides are made out of petroleum as well. You look at the social costs, you look at the petroleum costs,
sure,
and suddenly factory farming not only is no longer economical, it becomes more expensive than local farming.
Yeah, a long-distance food system is only possible in an era of cheap oil, and we know increasingly that era is coming to a close. The nutritional deficiencies that you mention are maybe the most ironic part of our food system. We have a lot of food in this country. We are we can crank out a lot of food on our large farms, and it's amazing that even in a country awash in abundance, there are still these sorts of deficiencies. Not the same sorts of deficiencies you get in incredibly poor countries in Asia or Africa.
Yeah, we don't have kwashiorkor or beriberi, but we do have obesity, which is oddly enough at the very least a nutritional aberration disease, and many would argue a nutritional deficiency disease.
And there's a direct connection between the way we raise food in this country and those sorts of nutritional deficiencies. And just to give an example from the Midwest, the vast majority of the Midwest grows two crops, corn and soybeans. It's not a very diverse system. This is partly because those crops are heavily subsidized by the government, so farmers have a real incentive to grow them and not to shift into other crops. We have so much of these crops that we end up sort of turning them into any number of products, from soy oil to high fructose corn syrup, to animal feed, which when you feed animals on that diet, it becomes sort of overly fatty meat, which we know also isn't very healthy. And in many of those communities in the Midwest that are awash in corn and soybeans, they can't possibly live on those two crops. And so you have a situation where they're producing giant mountains of these crops, and at the same time shipping that out to be used by processors and exported to other countries.
And wiping out small farmers in other countries.
And at the same time, they have to import everything that they're eating locally, the whatever vegetables, whatever other foods, because no one can live on corn and soybeans. And so local food in many ways is about getting that diversity back into the food system, but also back into our diets.
Yeah, it's just a matter of getting back to it. My wife's grandmother grew up on a farm, lived on a farm her whole, virtually her entire life, sailed through the Great Depression. All she had to buy was salt and sugar. I mean, that was it. You know, sailed through the Great Depression. This little 100-acre farm in Michigan, doing very well. Brian Halwell, the senior researcher with the World Watch Institute. His book is Eat Here, the World Watch Institute's website, worldwatch.org. Brian, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, it was my pleasure, Tom. Thank
you. Great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Up next, an update from the belly of the beast with the Talk Radio News Service. We'll be back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
What would Jefferson do? What would Jefferson say if he saw his democracy fading away and corporate power and greed ruling the day? Well, it's too high a price for America to pay. Our Constitution tells us we must disobey. For this government of the people will be swept away. Bringing democracy back to the USA, 'cause it's slipping further and further away. And remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ear.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones, our minority senior whip correspondent from Washington, D.C. on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
That was the sound of me cracking it.
I see. Oh, okay. Well, you have a minority whip story for us today?
I do. Steny Hoyer, the minority whip, holds, as does John Boehner, the majority whip, they hold these pen and pad briefings once a week. And what these are for your listeners is you go in there as a journalist. You can take a tape recorder. You can record it, but you cannot use the sound or the you certainly cannot use a camera. All you can use is whatever you've written down. So it's pen and pad, basically. So I took some notes, and so I've got some exclusives for you.
Okay, great.
Just a few things that he said, but that nobody else has got yet, because
before you get to the specifics, I'm curious. Any response by Steny Hoyer to John Murtha's challenge of him?
That's sort of old news now, really.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
So it didn't come up today.
Yeah. All right. So on with the exclusives then.
This is the most fiscally irresponsible administration and Republican leadership in the history of this country.
Yeah, well, we already knew that.
Well, I know, but nevertheless, it's quite a cool quote.
So, okay, all right, I'll give you that. And actually, what's pretty impressive is that the Democrats are starting to say what we've all known for years.
Yeah, he's actually going to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good on you, Steny Hoyer.
Yeah, he actually stood up and he said it. On Iraq, he said, he claimed the Democrats united in saying this should be a year of transition, turning things over to the Iraqis. The administration's policies are not designed for success in the short or the long term. There's no accountability with money, no big contracts, failure to equip, Abu Ghraib, failure of oversight by the House of Representatives.
Did they throw Joe Lieberman out of the party?
Yes, I believe they did yesterday.
I see. You're being facetious. Also.
I am. Yeah. I am. But this is the thing. He says they're united, and yet meanwhile over in the Senate, we've got amendments being offered by Kerry and others that differ from each other, and you've got Hillary Clinton saying that we shouldn't set a date. You know,
and then you got Ron Wyden saying let's get out by 2009, and you got John Kerry saying let's get out by 2007.
I mean, you know, and I'm quite sure you've got others saying let's get out tomorrow.
Yeah.
So they're not united on this, and they don't seem to recognize that this is a problem for them.
Well, at least they're united on the meme or the argument or the whatever you want to call it that it's time to get out. What they need to be united on, in my opinion, and I wrote about this on commondreams.org yesterday, boy, I've gotten an enormous amount of feedback on this thing from some people within the Democratic Party even. What they need to be united about is to stop calling this a war. because Americans hate to lose wars. And if you're calling something a war and you're saying we need to walk away from it, you're calling for the loss of a war. And nobody can win politically on that. They need to start calling it an occupation, because that's what it is. The war was over in May of 2003 when we took down the Iraqi government. You fight a war against the government of another country, and when you defeat their army, you destroy their air force, you blow up their navy, you wipe out their Republican Guard, you seize control of their governmental buildings, you imprison their governmental leaders, and you take control of that country. You have won the war. We won the war in May of 2003. The war that started in March or April of 2003, we won it in May of 2003, and we began an occupation. Now, occupations are things that you logically end. You know, the UK and the United States, we ended our occupation of Germany. We ended our occupation of Japan. We still have troops there, but they're not occupying troops. The occupations ended within a year or two of the end of World War II, and it's time to end the occupation of Iraq.
So why doesn't somebody hire you as a speechwriter?
Well, actually, I used to do that sort of thing years ago, and I've done it.
Did you?
Yeah, in the corporate world, actually, yeah, and made very good money doing it.
I can believe it, because I've never heard it put more clearly.
Yeah, well, this is you know, without getting into my CV, I mean, this is just such a simple meme. And as long as the Democrats keep referring to this as a war, and anytime anybody in the media says war in Iraq, if there's any Democrat with an earshot, they should say, "You mean the occupation of Iraq?" And if they can change that meme so that the average American, so the Joe Sixpack, is thinking, oh, it's the occupation of Iraq, then when they say, you know, it's time to end the occupation, everybody go, yeah, that's right. You're supposed to end occupations. You're not supposed to lose wars, though.
No, you're not supposed to lose wars. So, there's no reason why we should lose a war.
Yeah, absolutely. And even wrong wars, Americans don't like to lose. And, you know, the Americans didn't like losing. Well, you're getting me off on a rant here, but Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, our senior minority whip, pen and pad correspondent. Victoria, great talking with you today.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Will do.
Thank you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. 27 minutes past there. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Time to take a look at what's going on with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Dateline Baghdad, this from Reuters. Two people are killed when a roadside bomb went off near a market in central Baghdad. In Swaria, Iraqi police retrieved the bodies of seven people from the Tigris River on Monday. The bodies were handcuffed, blindfolded, and bearing signs of torture, police added. Also in Swaria, a child was seriously wounded when a bomb planted outside a house exploded on Monday. And finally, the bodies of two U.S. soldiers mutilated and booby-trapped. One of them from my home state here in Oregon. The bodies of two U.S. soldiers found in Iraq Monday night were mutilated and booby-trapped, military sources said Tuesday. PFC Christian Menchaca, I hope I'm not mispronouncing that, and PFC Thomas L. Tucker went missing after a Friday attack in a traffic control checkpoint in Yusufia, 12 miles south of Baghdad. The sources said the two men had suffered severe trauma. The bodies had also been desecrated, and visual identification was impossible. Part of the reason DNA testing was being done. This and not only were the bodies booby-trapped, but improvised explosive devices also lined the road leading to the victims, an apparent effort to complicate recovery efforts and target recovery teams, the sources said. It took troops 12 hours to clear the area of IEDs. One of the bombs exploded with no injuries. This is sick. And it's what happens when you occupy another country and they don't want you there. Give me that email, David. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. I just got an email here from a fellow in Puyallup, Washington. I'm probably mispronouncing that, too. Puyallup? Puyallup. Thank you. He says, I caught part of your monologue this morning blaming America for the death and torture of over 100 terrorists. No, I'm not blaming America for it. I'm blaming George W. Bush for it and Alberto Gonzalez for violating the traditions that America was built on. We would not and did not do this sort of thing in World War II, and we were fighting a force of evil that is almost unimaginable. He goes on to say, you say that because of our alleged treatment of these terrorists that the two soldiers who were murdered by these vermin was somehow justified. No, I didn't say that. You're hallucinating. You need to change your medication, Mr. Schoaf. He says, not exactly your words, but the meaning of what you said is the same. No, as I said, you're hallucinating. He says, I can only tell you this, punk. You're a rotten pinko twerp born of a pig. See, this is what happens when people of limited intelligence try to argue politics. They start calling names. It's really, I mean, this is an indication of the tragic state of the so-called conservative mind in America. He says, you had better hope that you don't somehow end up among a bunch of military and retired military men in a dark bar some night. I looked you up on your website, and you looked just like I would have expected a yellow-livered pinko commie to look like, beard and all, limp-wristed bastard. Have a good day salivating over the death of men you can't even imagine holding a candle to. J. Schoaf, Puyallup, Washington. Well, Mr. Schoaf, I don't know what to say. It's like, I have a lot of very good friends. I've spent a lot of time in dark bars with guys in the military. Drank a lot of beer with them. For folks like this to just go off on these things about blaming America. Don't you get it? Jay, don't you get it? There are people using your name and mine to perpetrate atrocities in the world in our names. And because of that, other people in the world are blowing back at us saying no. And they're doing it in horrific and vicious ways. Osama bin Laden, right from the, you go back all the way to 9/11. Back in the 1990s, Osama bin Laden declared he was coming to get the United States. Why? Because he said, number one, we were propping up a corrupt dictatorship in Saudi Arabia, which is true. And number two, he said, because we had stationed troops on Saudi soil, on holy Saudi soil, and those men were drinking alcohol and watching pornography, and those women had their elbows uncovered. Well, George W. Bush, in his infinite wisdom as president, moved the troops out of Saudi Arabia. He got rid of half of Osama bin Laden's reasons for attacking us. But it had nothing to do with hating our freedoms. It had to do with hating our foreign policy. And if we hadn't gotten addicted to the oil coming from Saudi Arabia, if we had done what Jimmy Carter said, and let's break the addiction to Middle Eastern oil, we never would have had 9/11. And you wouldn't be running around doing these, frankly, rather pathetic rants. Because you're obviously terrified of these people. Get a grip, man. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I called to talk about Bill O'Reilly, but while I was waiting, I so agree with you when you talked about calling it an occupation. And I looked up a quote. President Bush also called this an occupation. On May 28, 2004, interview of the president by Paris Match magazine. He said they don't like to be occupied. That's why we're handing over sovereignty. And he goes on to say, well, full sovereignty will happen June 30, 2004. I fully understand the people not wanting to be occupied. I wouldn't either. So,
I think
so. He declared that the occupation was going to be ended on June 30th of 2004.
2004, and this was, again, interview of the president by Paris Match magazine. I heard him say it, but I just looked it up, and it's on the web, on the White House website.
Well, good on you, Cynthia.
Thank Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, good old Bill. He's
so happened to be at Gitmo when these suicides happened.
Well, he left actually the day before, did he not?
I'm not sure, but I found something about Fox that said he was going to be there. So did he comment about this on his show?
Yeah, John Stewart did a little joke thing about it on The Daily Show where he said there were three suicides at Guantanamo Bay, and then he plays, you know, Bill O'Reilly saying, and I just came back from Guantanamo Bay. I believe that he was there just before it happened. And came
I'd like to know, has he spoken of the detainees who were sold into captivity or any of the minors that were being held there?
He did, to the best of my knowledge, he did not speak with any of the detainees. Typically, reporters are not allowed to even establish eye contact with them.
Well, no, I said of them. I mean, because, you know, there are things. I really have to question the circumstances surrounding the deaths now that the media has been banned from going in there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot that we're not being told. And I also would like to comment on the deaths of the barbaric deaths of our soldiers recently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I question everything that was going on there, and I want to know why aren't we hearing about any of the people, the mercenaries from, say, South Africa and Chile that are operating with Negroponte's death squads that were there. We don't know who did this. You have this new Lee Harvey, Mujahideen, or whatever they say his name is. Now he's claiming credit for this.
After
we just conveniently got rid of Zarqawi, whose body still hasn't been turned over to his family, by the way.
Yeah, not that any of us, frankly, mourn that. But
no, of course not. You know, good riddance to him. But I want to know who is really responsible and whose payroll they really are on.
Well, there's a weird symbiosis here between any group that wants to take credit for this stuff and the Bush administration, because Bush needs to have an anti-hero. He needs to have a super evil, a super villain. And the villains need to have Bush hate them in order to raise their profile. I mean, Osama bin Laden wanted Bush to overreact, just like Tim McVeigh wanted Clinton to overreact. Clinton didn't give McVeigh the pleasure of that. Bush did. Bush gave Osama bin Laden exactly what he wanted. In fact, I thought one of the more interesting footnotes in the story about when they took out Zarqawi was when they went through the papers.
The
they found the documents. They found that he was trying to goad the United States into attacking Iran.
The neocons one.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. There's a symbiotic relationship between the two of them. And then they get, you know, the average Americans just totally befuddled about this stuff going, you know, I don't understand those pinkos, communists. Yeah, it's incredible. Cynthia.
The man that wrote you, there's a quote, Hitler said, nothing drives people faster than the fear of sudden death. That applies to that guy.
There you go. Cynthia, thanks a lot for the call.
You.
Good talking to you. Randy in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Randy.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to ask you, because I'm afraid to go on the Internet and check out, but I was curious, you were talking about Hezbollah earlier, and it seemed to me that they didn't turn radical until we bombed their neighborhoods back in 83, right before the Marines died.
You know, I have to confess, I don't know the history of Hezbollah.
I mean, I was wondering if some way you could check on that. I mean, it seemed to me that they went radical when we decided to get involved and start bombing the Shiite neighborhoods in Beirut in 83. Then the Marines were killed, and then the next day we invaded Grenada to a great victory, and I'd never even heard of the country prior to that. And
I have to say, Randy, I'm not sure. Perhaps somebody will call in who knows, and you know, we can poke around and find out. It is not a group that I, you know, I mean I know who they are, but I just don't know their history back in the 1980s, so I can't say.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is that we have radicalized the entire Muslim world. I mean, that nobody is disputing. And Bush, you know, is sending Boynton around to say our God is bigger than your God and all this kind of stuff. I mean, this is what is responsible for the death of our soldiers. 45 minutes past that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. I've been working on vacation, chasing hares and moles. Cindy, she had not withstanding, and I never read the polls. What's the point? I've made no mistakes I know of. That's just not like me. I subscribe to presidential infallibility.
All right, enough of you, George. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. A pill that will help you escape the matrix. Florindo in New York City. Hey, Florindo, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's nice to hear you again. I'm just following up on what you said earlier about the Nuremberg business. And my point is that there's a certain irony to this, which I really love, in spite of it all. The irony being that now that we've set this high moral standard back in the Nuremberg era.
Back in the late 40s, early 50s.
We're going to have to be measured by the standard we've set for everybody else.
Or we're going to change the world so that that's no longer the standard. And that's actually what's going on right now. And that's the truly tragic thing. When the world moves away from civilized behavior and toward barbarity, when revenge becomes the order of the day, we spiral down out of civilization into barbarism, and you end up with things like these whacked out emails nothing compared to this stuff that I
get. Yeah, just a cycle of hatred and violence.
And what happened to our soldiers? I mean, the fact that you have people in Iraq who 2 years ago, 2 years, well, 4 years ago, you know, we've been in there a little over 3 years. So 4 years ago, setting aside Saddam Hussein, if you could get past Saddam Hussein, Americans walking around, Scott Ritter talked about it on this program, traveling around Iraq as a weapons inspector. People were like, hey, you're an American. Cool.
Yeah.
We like you guys. We want to be like you guys. You're our role model. Please help us get rid of our president so we can have a country like you. It was a secular perspective. Iraq, of course, was a secular government.
The point is, it's going to be up to us now to reverse that downward spiral by, first of all, impeaching these guys, second of all, bringing them to trial for these war crimes, and third of all, making a public spectacle to the world about how we're going to recover that standard by even meeting out justice to our own leaders when it's appropriate.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank
tragically.
You.
Tragically. Florindo, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. What's up?
Oh, I just want to tell you, amen, for what you said about Jefferson and Madison setting the examples. I couldn't agree with you more. And I got one other thing to say about this illegal immigration. Close those borders. Don't give them licenses. And how in the heck do they have such good jobs?
Okay. Thanks a lot, Dick. Good to hear from you. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David.
Oh, hey, Tom. You know, Bush also was saying that he wouldn't like to be occupied.
Yeah, this is the quote that I'm forgetting her name now. The caller a few minutes ago said, May 28th, 2004.
And yeah. I have it recorded, and I've seen it. And he had that same smirk that you just want to. Anyways, the Prime Minister of Austria recently said, or recently referred to Bush as a war criminal, and they're having this EU meeting, which he's there. Isn't he there like today or tomorrow?
Yeah, yeah.
So, he's entering some...
talk, 2 years ago when he was going to Europe about there being charges being brought in The Hague. And there was a terrible debate, or not terrible, but there was a loud and protracted debate that happened within the Dutch parliament about this. Mm-hmm. And also in Belgium. And then in Germany, the Alan Ratner's brother, Michael Ratner, his group, the name of which is escaping me at the moment, but... a human rights group, had filed charges against Bush and Rumsfeld in German courts for violations of war crimes. So,
the stage is being set, for sure.
Well, except that right at the moment, none of these governments are willing to do anything, just like there's no American politicians who are willing to do anything. I mean,
because look at the pattern for 5 years.
Look at what happens when you stand up to the mafia.
Well, they've shown their true colors, and it's taken 5 years to see what Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice have up their sleeve as far as their plans. I mean, it's not it's not gonna work. They're not gonna succeed. There's no way.
Yeah, David, good point and well said. Thank you very much, Oren in Essex Junction, Vermont, living on listening on WVAA. Hey, Oren, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Love your show. Hey, I wanted to tell you, I've told you before, I'm Republican since I was starting to vote, and I'm retired military. And I want to let you know, anytime that guy wants to give you any grief, here's a retired military that's more than happy to cover your back.
Oh, thank you.
And,
thank you,
I can't believe, you know, I don't see the Republican Party that I grew up with when I was 18, 20 years old. I'm 50 now.
Yeah.
You know, they're neocons now. They're and this guy is a case in point. You know, I went to serve my country and to try to make it to where to ensure people had the right to say what they wanted to say,
mm-hmm.
and not, you know, offer to get whipped for it.
I got to tell you, you know, if Dwight Eisenhower ran on the platform of vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace. I mean, I think if Dwight Eisenhower came back today, he would not recognize the party.
I don't think so. And you know, I'm questioning my orientation now politically.
Uh-huh.
I'm really beginning to wonder.
Well,
so,
see,
I
haven't joined the Democratic Party. I think that there's a lot of hope in, frankly, taking over the Democratic Party. But as long as they've got Joe Lieberman, they don't have me yet. But, Oren, thanks a lot for the call.
I don't see a lot of difference in them. I think maybe progressives or something. But anyway, take care, Tom.
Thank you. Good to hear from you, and thanks for the offer of a drink. One of these days I'll get back out to Vermont, and I'll take you up on it. I'm out there regularly. Coming up on tomorrow's Tom Hartman program, conservative David Tebow says liberals are being urged to take on right-wing nuts in talk. I'll be saying, so what? Jeffrey Feldman's here with the frame Trust or Bust. Larry Scott from VA Watchdog dropping by. Is the U.S. ready for the next wave of unemployable vets? Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back.